This is News in No Time at Gordon. On today's roundtable, Alito moves one step closer and controversy over a new film about a black Jesus. Joining us to discuss these topics and more from our headquarters in Washington, D.C., Mary Frances Berry, professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania. Roland Martin, executive editor of the Chicago Defender, joins us from member station WCLK in Atlanta, Georgia today, and at our member station WFDD in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, Nat Irvin, professor of future studies at Wake Forest University. All right, folks, we want to get into a number of things today. First, we want to talk about the president and what the White House seems to be doing. We saw him in front of an audience yesterday, not only delivering a quite long speech, but taking questions. And obviously, front and center was the notion of the unauthorized surveillance of Americans. The president is standing by the fact that he says that he did not break the law by authorizing domestic eavesdropping, and suggests that this all now falls under Mary Frances Berry, the umbrella of what he calls the terrorist surveillance program. And in plain terms, he says, look, you can't have it both ways. You either accept spying or terrorism.
Well, actually, the foreign intelligence law that was passed makes clear that there are procedures that the president should follow when he wants to wiretap. He obviously has violated that law. I mean, that's clear. The Congressional Research Service says it. Even the Washington Post editorial, which usually supports what he does on these issues, says and acknowledges that what he's done is not, he's violated what is there as the law. That law has all kinds of provisions that would make it easy for him to go. He also said something about he has briefed members of Congress. The foreign intelligence, the law says that he has to brief all the members of the committee, which he didn't do. And so I think that the polls show that Americans believe that the president should follow the law. They also are afraid, and I think that what he's doing is like you wave the boogeyman at kids to get them to stop misbehaving. He keeps waving terrorism at us and has been doing it since 9/11 to frighten everybody. And I think we're in for a setup, too, because Pat Roberts, who's chair of the committee, Intelligence Committee, was there, and he was in Manhattan, Kansas yesterday. And Senator Specter is going to chair the committee to investigate this. The Republicans, of course, control both houses of Congress, so that we're going to get a phony investigation. If the checks and balances system worked, yeah, and if at least one house of Congress was controlled by somebody else, right now we would be seeing an investigation toward an impeachment of Bush for violating the law.
Well, here's an interesting point, Nat Irvin. Here's an interesting point. As Mary suggested, 56% of the people polled recently suggested that the Bush administration should be required to seek a warrant before electronically monitoring American citizens. Yet, what this White House has always done, and what even critics of this president say he is good at, is going and talking to people, pressing the flesh, and winning them back over. Clearly, the White House has him out doing that.
Oh, man, he had the Richard Pryor defense yesterday, which is who are you going to believe, me or your lying eyes? And if you were to say it, who are you going to believe, me or Osama bin Laden? Americans believe him. I mean, it's absolutely a brilliant turn of the phrase, as Mary mentioned, to the terrorist surveillance program from domestic spying. I mean, who's going to be opposed to Americans' values of apple pie, hot dog and ice cream? I mean, what you're talking about, the president is saying, look, folks, we're going to be attacked. I am not spying on you. I'm spying on those who would do us harm. I'm spying on the, quote, and I have my hands up here, the folks who are the folks who are associated with Islam. I mean, you know, and then this is all aided, of course, by the very right-wing talk show hosts that we have, and I won't mention any of them, who simply just help to reinforce the notion that the president is not spying on you. He's spying on them. The only time Americans right now seem to be concerned about spying is if you mention the IRS. Other than that, I think that we're very much like we were as a country during the 1940s, when we were afraid of the yellow peril. Now it is we are afraid of Osama bin Laden and anybody associated with al-Qaeda, and we are willing to give up apparently a lot of civil rights and not even civil liberties and not even ask any questions.
Roland Martin, it's clear that the White House is going to, and Republicans are going to adopt this strategy, cloak all of this with the idea as a central campaign issue for November. We heard White House advisor Karl Rove state very clearly this week that that's what should be done. What of the point that maybe liberals do have this all wrong? Maybe middle America is saying, look, I'm willing to give up civil liberties if I'm not doing anything wrong, as long as you're perhaps not peeking in my bedroom, you want to tap my phone for a minute, go ahead.
Well, I think the problem here is that liberals don't know how to construct a proper argument to rebut the president. The key for them, I think, in this case is to say, look, Mr. President, this is the law. This is what it says. You have the right to eavesdrop, and you have up to 72 hours to get a warrant. And so when he says, oh, I didn't break the law, you know, we informed everyone, he's shading up the actual facts. And so as long as they don't know how to articulate a proper argument, they're going to lose. And so Karl Rove is sending a signal again. It is going to be about security. In 2004, he said it is going to be about terrorism. The Democrats continue to be weak on this particular issue. They cannot articulate properly, and so they're going to have a tough time unless they are able to come up with some kind of message that can indeed resonate with the American people.
But Roland, they have, of course, a tough job to do, the Democrats, because, first of all, they don't control any of the branches of the government, so they have no platform. And when you control all the branches of the government, you can orchestrate events, as we see, on everything, not just
this. But you know what, Mary, that being said, it seems to me this White House may have been able to supersede all of the problems that they've had, avoid them, if you will, had they just gone to Congress beforehand, sat down with leadership on both sides of the aisle and said, look, gentlemen and ladies, this is what we need to do to keep this country safe. This is what I'm looking at. If you do the preemptive strike sometimes in Washington, as you well know, you don't have to face the same headaches.
But, Ed,
what
we're missing here is that that's not what they want to do. What they want to do is not to consult with anybody else.
Absolutely.
Not consult in a bipartisan way. Mm-hmm. They want to make the Democrats appear to be people who are not weak on war. And the way you do that is keep heightening the contradictions, heighten the issues. You don't have a cooperative stance.
You
have a fighting stance. And that's what they want to do.
Right.
All right, let's move to something else that some suggest the Democrats are missing the boat on in terms of just being able to articulate it, as Roland suggests. And Roland, pick up on this, if you will. And that is, of course, the fight for Judge Alito, his nomination to the Supreme Court. First step is passed. Today, it seems that the Judiciary Committee will give its okay, probably along party lines here, to say that the nomination go to full Senate. It does not look as though Democrats are going to muster up enough courage, if you will, or even see the sense in filibustering, something that many people see as just inevitable.
Well, I think they boxed themselves in initially. Coming out, several people who came out when he was first nominated talked about how great of a person he was and how qualified he was. And see, they continued to use this barometer of if you went to Harvard, you went to Yale, you were a prosecutor, the ABA gives you great marks. Well, you're a qualified candidate. And so that somehow allows you to overlook his views on so many different issues. I mean, anybody can see that the man is a flaming conservative. And so for him to sit there in the hearings and to basically deny the last 15, 20 years is simply a creative lie by a Supreme Court nominee. And that's simply what it is.
But, Roland, but it's nothing wrong with him being a conservative. And I don't think that's where the Democrats made their mistake.
No, I have no problem with that. But don't sit there and tell me I'm really not. I sort of felt that way 15 years ago, but I have an open mind today. Right.
Yeah. Well, but see, that's a different issue. I think where the Democrats, let me not pursue it in that context, just saying it's the Democrats who have lost this. The American people voted for this president. He has nominated Sam Alito. And now what we have is a candidate who went before the Judiciary Committee and who was a very technical judge, a man who could explain himself, who could explain away everything. In fact, I remember, if I'm not mistaken, there was one question where he could legally, he was unable to explain technically why it might be unconstitutional to execute an innocent person. I mean, what I found distressing about the complete hearings is that, you know, out of the 500 questions that were answered, there was no illumination on anything.
Yeah.
This was
the
basically hearing, just a technical display of legal judicial philosophy.
The hearings are a joke.
I mean, we all can
say
that.
They just never went
anywhere.
We
all agree on that. We talked about that last week. But, Mary, here's the question that Roland brings up that's interesting. The idea that you elected a man who has run on a conservative platform. You knew what you were going to get from Bush. And the idea that Democrats continue to say, to use Roland's verbiage, that these people are flaming conservatives. Well, okay, of course they are. That's not enough to keep you off the court, frankly.
Right.
What the Democrats need to learn how to do is to fight and not be afraid to fight with bare knuckles like the Republicans do. This all started with the 2000 election when they didn't fight and Bush was given the election by the Supreme Court, and they didn't fight, starting from Al Gore all the way down, even though they had a basis for fighting to show that they had some guts. And the Republicans learned that they don't have any guts. They don't fight on anything. So, of course, he gets reelected in 2004 because, you know, once you're elected, it's hard not to get reelected unless you're his father. But in any case, then the next thing that happens is on these issues, they don't fight. They caved in on the filibuster, gave it away, which was the only thing that they had, and got up in public and tried to make it sound like they weren't giving it away. That's because the Democratic Party internally is divided between those who want to fight and those who see that they ought to make themselves appear to be different and not. So the Alito outcome is a result of that non-fighting stance which has prevailed. And what I'm worried about, everybody keeps talking about abortion. I'm worried about the race cases. I'm worried about the Michigan case, which was 5-4, and Justice Kennedy didn't vote on that.
Through.
I mean,
yeah, the affirmative
he voted
action
on the
question
Casey
there.
The other way. I'm worried about all these things, but the Democrats have to learn how to fight.
Let me note this, that it could, in fact, go to the full Senate vote as early as this week. Let us turn our attention to a movie that's raising a lot of eyebrows at the Sundance Film Festival and a lot of other places. It's a movie called Son of Man. It portrays Christ as a modern African revolutionary. And what's interesting here is that the aim, the filmmakers say, is to shatter the Western image of the Savior with fair hair and blue eyes. Now, Nat, you know, religion and politics, we've already jumped in the pool with politics. We might as well with religion. When you look at the traditional image of Jesus and you see what this movie and others before it have tried to do, is there a need really today to revisit the image of Jesus and what Western society has portrayed this man to be physically?
Oh, I think there is always, and there is a constant. Let me put it this way: there's always a struggle within the faith community to reexamine the message of Christ, and I think even more so today than ever before, and that this film is representative of new communities having technology and having a story and being able to put the story of Jesus in their context. I think it's, you know, right here at home, we're looking at, I think it's an NBC series, The Book of Daniel, in which the American Family Council is outraged by the portrayal of Jesus as being sort of I've seen a couple of installments. I don't think this Jesus has blue eyes, but he is a sort of a modern contemporary figure who is very passive and who sort of offers these kind of non-controversial judgments. So I think the idea that now we have a filmmaker who has cast Jesus in context of South Africa, or at least Africa. I don't know if it's necessarily South Africa.
Roland,
I think it's exciting.
Roland, always interesting to see when you go to your grandma or your auntie's house to see Jesus looking like one of the Beatles in the mid-70s. What of the thought of putting a new face on him?
Well, I think it is vitally important, and frankly, I would tell any white evangelical any African-American, Hispanic, you name it, who disagrees with this, they need to shut up and be quiet, because if you try to suggest that Jesus represents all, then you should not be bothered by a black Jesus. You should not be bothered with that, because it is indeed the message that counts. And so, frankly, to be able to put it in its proper historical perspective, to me, makes sense. But this is one of those things that we have to demand is told properly, because there is indeed this view that Jesus was a white man, and you better believe that, and that's the only thing that you should believe, as opposed to Jesus representing all, as opposed to simply those who are white.
Mary?
Well, I just think that this has happened before in the 1960s. I remember at the Shrine of the Black Madonna in Detroit, and some of the cultural nationalists redefining, and there were books on Jesus as black. So we've had that before, people understanding that Jesus is universal and will represent him as being as we are. I think that every people wants to do that at some point, and people who believe in Christianity ought to welcome it, because all it does is expand the number of people who will be attracted to the religion.
Well, it'll be interesting to see, as Mary, you point out, this is not new, and the debate is ongoing when you talk about the woolen hair and the color of sand, et cetera, et cetera. So it'll be interesting to see how it plays itself out. Mary Frances Berry joining us from Washington, D.C. today, Roland Martin from Atlanta by way of Chicago, and Nat Irvin down there in North Carolina. I thank you all for joining us. Greatly appreciate it.